Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Through the Wind Door, where today we're getting right back into Tiger's Eye. It is today, and we are talking about Tiger's Eye. I didn't even intend that joke, but there it is.
I would say perfect, but the problem is I don't know if I can resist making the typical cat perfect pun.
I mean, you literally just hung a lampshade on that, so, you know, we'll just... As we mean to go on, this is us.
Oh, boy. It is today, and I am already a shambles.
You are Toby's regret. All of a sudden, we're getting into... God. That could have been funnier if I'd, like, you know, again... I'm sorry.
No, let's get real. Let me invite my inner, like, negative machinations that I'm sure they'll be a great thing. Hey, what did you think of this New Century book? It's good, but can you ever create anything yourself? Okay, we're putting you back into the corner. No, go away.
All of a sudden, we're... including our own versions of the warm one and the cold one here. Sorry,
that's a long way away from Tiger's Eye, but hey, little plug.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why I'm plugging. I'm stopping this. We're close and reopen the window. Run the opening music again. Hello, welcome to Through the Window, where nothing could possibly go wrong. We're looking at Weirdwood. Shit, do it again.
I don't know what's going on. We're awfully punchy. Maybe we're just feeling a little daunted, perhaps, at taking this on, because
we got to do it justice.
Yeah, we do, but... When I first started coming up with the questions for chapters 6 through 10, and we were starting to get into the serious meat of it, it occurred to me just how many big topics there are that are not big topics in the same way that talking about race relations are, or in talking about any of the other monumental subjects we've had along the way. The big topics here are far more...
personal.
Personal, but also on the level of the differences in storytelling and, like, foundational in terms of the way stories are told and the way life is. Like, I'm not trying to make it out like this is a conversation about life, the universe, and everything, but when we reflect on...
I'll just throw out all my show notes.
The thing that we're experiencing here, I think the word you just used a moment ago, very personal, is kind of pertinent to that, because...
Pertinent?
No, you won't. Don't lie to me. We both know you won't stop. It's just, well, I think the best way to explain how we feel about it and why things are the way they are is just get right to the topic list. So, very briefly, because we kept on missing over the fact, this is going to be chapters 6 through 10 today. Again, we're going to be continuing to try to do our 5 chapters per episode. It does divide out very nicely. I don't yet know if that will continue to work, but I think so, because... When I was starting this out, I was like, okay, this is what we're going to do for this episode. But going forward, let's see, does 6 through 10 encompass a good arc? Yeah, that seems to be okay. Does 11 through 15, does that encompass a good arc? Does that leave us in an interesting place, or does it plop us down the middle of something? And when I looked, I was like, no, that seems to be working okay too. So really, unless when I start putting down questions or when I start drilling down on the full re-listen as opposed to just the Cliff's Notes, browsing forward to see, okay, so this is when that happens. We'll see for ourselves if it feels like individual moments feel heavier, but I don't think we're necessarily... Okay, hold on a second. We might get there, because it just occurred to me that as soon as we get on board the whale, we're going to have a different scene to talk about. Okay, we're moving way ahead.
Yep. I mean, that's getting cut out with, like, what whale? We're not talking about that,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
All joking aside, as new episodes get released, things will end up being a little bit more complicated structurally than expected. We'll address these things as we go, of course, but just briefly, one of the things we did not consider is that when I started planning out future episodes, I was working off the template of the novel rather than the audio drama. And due to a couple different reasons, the audio drama has two more chapters than the novel does. That will not be important until a little bit further down the road, but we will point it out when relevant. This episode will proceed as normal, with an approximately 2-hour and 30-minute Skype conversation being divided into the two smaller episodes of about half that runtime. However, when we get to covering chapters 11 to 15, that ended up being so bulky that we recorded two separate sessions, each of them close to 2 hours by themselves. As always happens, that will get edited down some, but it's entirely possible that our discussion of the middle portion of this story will come out to close to 3 or even 4 1-hour episodes. I'm sure no one will mind having more content to listen to. Alex and Sharon are always going on about how it always feels over too soon. But it does make for a complicated numbering scheme, because I still tend to refer to these weekly episodes as smaller parts of a greater whole, rather than individual episodes in their own right. That said, I think I'll keep it as is. It may not be as clean archival-wise, but it does make clear that the divided episodes are sectioned-off portions of a larger conversation, encompassing a set number of chapters. I always do my best to find good places to pause till next week, but I also want to make it clear that you need parts A and B, or even C and D, to get the complete picture. So, here's point number one.
Of several.
We've got a list today. The depth that the audio drama can give can also sometimes confuse. Unlike being able to turn on subtitles for a movie, the things that we can hear are all we have unless we also have the novel to compare. This came into focus specifically in Chapter 6, where Hrau is talking about Miguel's response to eating the ibex. When I first heard this, what I was hearing when Hrau was talking about, he doesn't seem to be bothered by this and expressed some familiarity with it. And the phonetics that I heard were Miguel pointing at the ibex and saying, "It's good, it's good." And it was only once I would back to the actual text, as per my usual, I bounce between the two in terms of whatever it is works better to review at that time. Like, I'm more likely to listen to the podcast if I'm in my car.
Sorry. When you want to zero in on the language and the words, the book might offer a easier way of seeing what is there in the text.
Yeah, but not only that, it's just be like, maybe I'm not waiting for the bus. I don't have to wait for the bus. But, you know, if I have a moment, I'm just on my phone anyway. Maybe instead of pulling up Twitter, which, you know, Twitter is a double-edged sword that is very easy to cut yourself on.
Yeah, that's its own can of rat snakes.
Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, in the elevator or whatever, and I want to continue whatever work that I was doing. The thing that I discovered through reading it is that what Miguel was actually saying was that he recognizes the ibex, either the flavor, but I think actually the appearance, that it's the ibex is a goat. And that doesn't make that expression of it bad. I mean, let's face it, as established, the audio drama is capable of doing things that the text is not, such as make it clear that someone is saying something rather than just having someone narrate that someone is saying something. But then Alex can do the distortion, allowing for, I've said something, but it comes out as garbled nonsense, sort of add overall realism to the experience. And that helps.
Miguel sits in the right eye and chomps on a haunch of Ibex. I was cautious at first, but he signed at me that it almost certainly would not make him sick. In fact, he kept pointing at the beast as it roasted over the fire and saying a word repeatedly in his language, which confirmed a familiarity.
Stug. Stug.
But it also means if it feels like there is something that is being said that we are interpreting because our brains are trying to interpret the nonsense, even though we may understand that it's nonsense, it perhaps adds to the... There was a word or a term that you used when you were responding to this point that I was trying to make. You said, at the end of the day, the most important information to communicate for these chapters isn't the exact translation of what Miguel is saying. It's what Rao thinks he is saying.
Exactly. We're seeing her experience with him from her perspective, so her attempts, whether successful or not, at discerning the meaning of this covenant, his words are what the story is focusing on. And I think that Rao is intuitive enough that she kind of knows when she's actually got a good sense of what he's saying and when she has no idea. So it's not just relying on you having sort of outside contextual knowledge to know, oh no, she is picked up on the wrong thing. It's moments like I keep going back to, do you know where you're going or something? I don't think so. And even if you don't pick up on that's what Miguel is saying, Rao is saying, like, he said something, and I'm not sure I quite appreciate the tone of it. It's along those lines. And seeing that little bit there is enough to gauge that, okay, she is able to kind of establish some point of connection. It's, I don't like your sass, young man, but it's a connection all the same. That is the key takeaway from that moment, not that Miguel is being a sassy boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. But by the same, this is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but it's not too much of a spoiler to say that because of the first person perspective that the story continues to stay in, there are occasions where the fourth wall is broken slightly and the author allows us to know what is being said, even though Rao or whoever's perspective is doing the narrating doesn't necessarily know what's being said. It gives the audience context that the characters themselves do not have. Mm. And we see their reactions to whatever is going on as they are doing the interpreting of what is being said and, as you say, how it's being said. But it doesn't... It's a narrative conceit that, at the very least, if we are, like, the experience that we are already having may feel discombobulating, that whole thing where what he's actually saying is goat and what we think is he's saying is something else. And one interpretation of the story does make that clear. Another interpretation of the story doesn't necessarily make that clear. This is a sort of an exemplified version of that where, just in order to make the experience more enjoyable for the audience, we get to be in on things that the protagonists are not, just so we continue to be engaged with the story. Because confusion might be interesting from a narrative standpoint. It might not necessarily be as good from a storytelling standpoint, unless that's somehow the point of it.
And specifically a characterization point, because we need to develop enough of an understanding of Miguel's character that we see him, even if Rao is at times not necessarily allowing herself to see him as more than just a strange cub that needs to be taken away from this world. We have enough context to know, well, he's a human, we know his name, and so we have a bit of context of where he's from, but we get to develop an understanding of his personality, even if we aren't able to pick up on all of the words, we're able to pick up on enough of them that we are getting to know who he is, even before we have the chance to necessarily have everything confirmed to us.
And it also speaks a little bit to the difference between choosing to take in a story through your eyes, through text, and choosing to take a story in through your ears. I don't remember if we've had these conversations
yesterday or today.
Yeah, to use the nomenclature of the story we're working on. Specifically, I know that you and I have talked about this a little bit, or that me and Alex...
Greg, if we include everything that we've talked about, it's going to be a very lengthy list.
No, my point is that I know that we've talked about the experience of listening to something rather than reading something, and the strengths and weaknesses of both. Listening to Tiger's Eye lends itself far more to the immediacy of the story. And we get caught up in it, and so therefore the whirlwind aspect of it, as long as we comprehend the general oeuvre of what's going on, of scene to scene, action to action, word to word, then we are more or less getting the full experience. When you're reading the text, it's sort of easier for your eyes to flash back up to earlier on the page if you're like, well, I'm confused about what just happened. I'm just going to go back up. But of course, we don't live our lives where we can suddenly read back in the text. We don't necessarily have brains like James or anything like that, where we have perfect recall. And accomplishing that in the real world is not impossible, but it's far more complicated. Therefore, having this conversation where everything with Harao is now and everything with us is also now, the fact that the story works as well as it does to make all of that work and to integrate us, the audience, as being part of the story, that makes it overall a strength, even if it means that we have to go back and listen to or reread or whatever it is that we have to do in order to unpack things that we might have missed along the way, or to better understand the things that we were in the thrall of when we were originally experiencing the story.
Certainly, and I think that the difference between them is almost like the sense of, in the audio version, you're experiencing the flow of time that Tiger's Eye concerns itself with, everything being today, and things that happened yesterday are this memory. But when you read it, it's all sort of fixed. It's not flowing like audio can be, where, you know, you can rewind, but you can never pause on a sound, that you have to let it play. It's exactly like animation, where you can pause on an individual frame, but the actual process of animation happens between the frames, the movement. The sound is like that. You have to, by its very nature, experience it as a flowing continuum. The text is like a painting, which is framed as everything that is exists within the frame, and you can zero in on details and you can scan your eyes over it again and again. And I think that, to me, the flowing element of the audio complements the style of narration, but at the same time there is a benefit to having that level of crystallization in the details that the text provides. And I guess I would say it's the difference between walking around in a game and having a virtual space that you can move through, that would be the audio, and having all of the surface details stripped away and being able to see the code, that's what the text is. Which is very un-Tiger's Eye using a sort of technical analogy like that, but it's I think it's apposite.
Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. Listening to this conversation now causes me to reflect on certain other conversations and experiences that I've had since then. I grew up with books more than any other form of medium, which meant that I was always very text-focused, rather than audio-focused or visual-focused. My appreciation for those sorts of things came much later in life. Therefore, I was always biased towards a medium that you could dip in and out of very easily, and tended to be most interested in what people were saying, rather than rich detail of the visual world. It's why I bounced off Tolkien so hard. When the most recent New Century book, Uncivil Outlaw, came out in January 2020, I devoured it. I think I read the whole thing in 36 hours, and was blown away enough that it was the impetus that caused me to reach out to Toby to discuss it, and thus Through the Wind Door was born. But it was a surprise when, months later, I found out that many fans had not read the novel, and were instead waiting for the audio drama to be released to find out how it played out. And then, during the Uncivil Outlaw Q&A, Alex was shocked to hear that I held off listening to critical chapters of the audio drama, because I knew that the moments there would be hard to listen to play out, emotionally. He likened it to only being satisfied with the script and not the finished work. A month later, I watched Titanic for the first time ever. Because it was long and I was essentially watching it in between doing caretaking chores for my mother, it took 3 days to finish it. I mentioned all this on the Discord, as well as the fact that some parts of it didn't work for me, and the response from certain quarters was that perhaps the reason it wasn't as affecting was because I didn't let myself stay in the moment, sit there and watch it all in one go, like I would have had I seen the movie in the theater. Long story short, when I finished Titanic, I did eventually decide that I really liked it. But that conversation did stick with me, as well as my response that there were other pieces of media that I had no problems losing myself in that were not Titanic, Tiger's Eye being the example I used at the time. If there was something that I would admit about my media habits at age 44, it's that, like many, I respond easier to works that are either, like books, easy to dip in and out of, or are short enough that I can view them easily in between doing other things. Part of that is the modern world, with its short tweets, or TikTok clips, or even internet videos that are 15 minutes or less. I have no idea how much of this is just how my own brain works, and how much of it is modern media. Sometimes I find it hard to concentrate on something like, say, a children's cartoon, and that screws up the experience for me. But I can watch or even listen to long-form essays just fine on YouTube, unless my brain gets hung up on a thought and then I realize that I've been busy thinking and not paying attention to the video or the podcast, and have to rewind back so that I can understand what is being talked about. I can also watch TV shows at my mom's, like Billions or His Dark Materials, and be thoroughly riveted, even if I have to stop and put the wash in the dryer or get the tea. It's a truism that everyone responds to media differently. Maybe I would get more out of certain works if I was able to focus better. But speaking for myself, I've never had a problem focusing on New Century. That's why I said yes when asked about doing a podcast. Text or audio, it drew me in. I do appreciate how much the audio drama offers over the text, and as Toby and I have kept saying, Tiger's Eye is one of the best examples of that. The work of Maureen and Alex and all the rest make this world come alive and demands our attention. But having said all that, I must nonetheless point out that this podcast was still necessary for me to get every drop of meaning out of these works. That by diving deep with each book, did both Toby and I achieve a greater appreciation for everything that was here, above and beyond our original experience. So, As always, I hope that these meandering words and thoughts of ours offer as much to you, dear listeners, as they did to us. The fact that you love these stories enough that you're listening to a fan podcast means that the work did captivate and inspire you. But listening to us talk about these works may also offer up a fresh perspective that you might not have focused on along the way. The interesting thing that I've been noticing as we've been talking is the things that we've just been talking about, how interconnected those are with a whole bunch of other topics that are on our list. Like, I was thinking to myself, should I interject with it? No, I need to keep everything separate. But a lot of these things that we talk about when we talk about Tiger's Eye are interwoven in a certain way, which is why I want to just move now slightly on to the next topic, which is that part of the experience of creating a new world from scratch is...
All right, what color are the leaves?
Well, not necessarily talking about it from a minutiae detail, but as I recall, the unusual colors of Rama are a significant way of showing the alienness, much as, say, the red forest that James and Abigail see through the wind door that that Krieger and Greta escape.
Wait. Did you just title drop us?
Yeah, okay. One of the decisions that Alex made when he started trying to integrate us, rather to introduce us to this world, was to take names for creatures that actually exist in our world and introduce those as being the natives of Rama. And he uses concepts like the quagga, which was a subspecies of zebra. As we got into last episode, the quagga is an animal that most would not have heard of, because it became extinct over a century ago, and were only recently introduced back into the world 4 years ago through the efforts of scientists. And the ibex, which is a version of mountain goat, and just a bunch of other, like every now and then they'll use a word for an animal that is pretty standard in terms of just like birds or monkeys, but she'll also be more specific, like King Toucan or something like that. One can understand that the reason why he picks some of the names of things that he does is they are names that we might not necessarily be familiar with, or we may be familiar with as being exotic, and therefore that lends itself to the exoticness of this is not our world, this is an alien world.
But as demonstrated previously in last week's episode, I did not realize that the quagga was a real creature. I thought it was a fictional one.
Yeah, exactly. And so, therefore, one can also understand why it is that one might not want to come up with all new names for things, because then that tends to require a whole bunch of extra explanation as to what this thing is. There's a clip from Zero Punctuation that I'll probably use to explain this later on, that it can be perhaps a little bit frustrating when you come up with new words for existing ideas that, if you're not already familiar with them, they can sound egotistical is the wrong word. Pretentious is the word I'm looking for. As it turns out, I already used that clip in the first half of episode 15 for a different reason, and I don't feel the need to rehash. You understand what we're talking about. So, moving on. Alex instead be like, okay, I'll just find names for things that exist, and for those of people that, you know, understand what this is, that'll be like, oh yeah, I've heard of those things before. And it's a way to make things feel different without actually being different. The problem is that names mean things. Words mean things. When I was noticing one of these things off the top of my head, Alex mentions that he's not necessarily happy with the use of the word megastatherium, as in Chapter 7, which is meant to imply, you know, an ancient large creature. Because that word is so very obviously based in Latin. That's not a word that Hra would use, because she doesn't have any basis for stuff in Latin. My larger confusion at one point was as I was learning more about the Ibex for the previous question, or for the previous topic, rather, finding out that the Ibex was a mountain goat. And so therefore, we're like, wait, why would an Ibex be in the jungle? That makes no sense. And then suddenly going off on that tangent a little bit, so like, oh, so the quagga. Yeah, the quagga was in Africa, and we know that there are rainforests in Africa, but they're plains creatures. Hmm. The problem there is that it's not that it's a bad idea necessarily, and certainly when you're being carried away by the action, you're not immediately Googling.
Fixating.
Fixating on these individual things, unless you just happen to know exactly what they are. Mm. But it's still one of those unintentional consequences when you're attempting to do something, and in trying to avoid one problem, you're all of a sudden creating a different problem. Or maybe intentionally creating a different problem. One of my favorite quotes from The Good Place has always been,
anytime I had a problem and I threw a Molotov cocktail, boom, right away, I had a different problem.
He makes a strong case.
Oh, bless that show.
Yeah, exactly.
A very minor correction. I believe the megastatherium is actually originated from Greek. But, you know, that's fixating on an entirely different detail. But like, I could make an all, it's all Greek to me joke, but that's beneath me.
Come on, Toby. Don't lie to our audience like that. Both of us will go for the low-hanging fruit sometimes, but I think you like doing it even more than I do.
Yes, I will admit to having had the same thought when you say it, because that is a word that just every syllable of that just oozes classic language construction. It may as well just have a made in ancient civilization sticker on it. It stands out when you are seeing names like Hrau and Rama tied to this place. It's just these names that seem to flow from the kind of like speech that these creatures tend to favor, even though we are seeing them speak English, that's clearly for our benefit. But that word is just so like counterintuitive to the flowing growls and hisses. It's just mega stressed for you can't do it when you're channeling the. I'm actually amazed that Maureen
that a
feline was able
mouth
to
could make that. You're talking about the actual voice acting now.
Yeah, exactly. I am. I'm amazed that it was they were able to like actually say that and keep in character as Hrau.
Well, as it turns out, Maureen did have a problem with that word. Thanks to a request for some additional content from the old Behind the White Scars roundtables, here's a clip I gleaned from the collected outtakes at the end.
We take shelter in a small dry cave previously occupied by a megastatherium. Megastatherium? Megastatherium. Yeah, Alex, I'm going to need to redo that word because I have no idea.
As has been confirmed here, I'm positive that this has occurred to Alex as well, that word is slightly imperfect there. But it ultimately strikes me as relatively inconsequential and forgivable, because the point of using the term, as you have already established, is to invoke an ancient and unfamiliar creature that is alive and well here in Rama, which adds to the ongoing goal of painting the setting as simultaneously alien and primal. And as Alex wanted to invoke that creature specifically, and for a reader to know what it is he is specifically referring to from its name alone, he has to use its name. And since there is no alternative name for it, the derived from Greek one has to be the word we use, because it's not like it's still around for us to give new names to it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think that it's a rabbit hole to zero in on the term that's more obviously connected to recognizable ancient language from across the world, because etymology means that most of the words and terms that Hrau is using can be traced back to European and classical languages, but it's a conceit we accept for the sake of convenience and clarity in the narration.
Well, it sounds like the Wendigo behind you agree, so...
thank you.
I mean, the Wendigo can be particularly picky audience members every now and then, but, you know, they can be on our side as well. They understand the importance of narrative flow.
They appreciate no obstacles in the way of things. They tend to just like to go with the flow, as you say.
What occurs to me from discussing this and reviewing our notes on the subject, what we are experiencing feels a lot like, well, because it's first person, it's as if Hrau herself is telling us an ancient parable, almost. Not quite, because she's not talking about herself in the third person. Rather, she's not talking about, usually when we think about oral history or oral mythology, it's Anansi did this, or this woman faced the gods, or whatever experience it is. It's first person, and that's not necessarily exactly the same way for an oral mythology anyway, because we're supposed to be talking about things that happened a long time ago and happened to not the people that are here, happened to, like, the founders of this world, whether it's humans or gods. But thinking about it, if we view the text of Tiger's Eye as being a translation, like she related the story to somebody else and they later took it, put it down to words, much like a historian like Snorri Sturluson or other historians might have gone around and collected a whole bunch of stories that had only been passed down by mouth rather than ever written down due to the cultures not having a consistent written language, then one could almost imagine that these aren't necessarily the words that the speaker used anyway. This is the translation that is provided by the writer, in which case you can actually forgive the unusual inconsistencies here, because that's the bias and the fault of the author as opposed to whoever it is that is actually experiencing it. To be clear, when we say author in this case, we are not talking about Alex. He is the author in the larger sense, in that he wrote the story we are reviewing. In this case, we are referring to the idea of an author that exists either in that world telling Crow's story, or more intrinsically, the representation of the author that exists in our heads telling us this story. If that sounds confusing, then I'm going to refer people to a web video by Ian Danskin that I linked to a while back that explains this idea more thoroughly. But I am going to try and figure out how to do the thing where you set up a link that starts you partway through the video, as it is talking about these things in reference to the video game The Beginner's Guide, and I don't want to spoil it for those that might not have played it.
And it would almost make sense that if she was relaying this, it would be to someone who has an interest in anthropology and zoology, who might actually have that knowledge of creatures and be able to say, oh, that sounds like that one ancient creature that I'm aware of. This is all supposition of a completely, like, unknown secondhand author who's translating all of this, but... it's certainly feasible, and I think that it works within what is being set up here within the text.
Meanwhile, longtime fans of New Century are bouncing up and down at what we said, thinking to themselves, I know something you don't know, but that's as far as we're going to go with that particular...
listeners, we know it all. Look, there are chapters of Uncivil Outlaw we know of that you haven't heard yet.
Yeah, well, no, I'm sorry. When
by the time you hear this, you will have.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's very true, because this is probably not going to come out until sometime in January at the current rate, or at the very least late December. Obviously, these predictions were made back when I thought that we were going to be doing the episodes for The Cartographer's Handbook before Tiger's Eye. As it is, very, very late November, early December. Not bad. But no, I was thinking about it not from the perspective like we don't know it, but that there are things that we can't talk about because it involves future knowledge as well. So once more, we will swiftly move on to the next topic.
Put your hand down, Hermione.
I have questions. I've never seen a single moment of Harry Potter, and yet there are certain things that are a part of my lexicon now because people have made references to that in School of Movies or in places of Through the Window itself. And so therefore, when you just said, put your hand down, Hermione, I just remembering that one time when Alex quoted that and Sharon was in the background going, I have questions. Unfortunately, I do not remember which podcast that moment was from, or I would have clipped it to share. That said, I think I got the quote wrong, and what Sharon actually said was, I have thoughts.
We're looking forward to our next interview with them. You will probably have heard that by now.
Yeah, exactly. It's just that that's our own little shared lexicon now through the experience of School of Movies. So, in Chapter 6, when we are exploring the home of the Silent One, we suddenly get an unbiased further understanding of the history of Rama, because we are looking at these artistic depictions of a Windor existing in the past and cats having made contact with humans. And based on this new information and the oral history that Haka related to us all the way back in Chapter 1, it naturally makes us ask more questions about how Rama has intersected with humans both as a part of this world, as well as, clearly, potentially part of another world. And we don't necessarily know what's going on there yet. From the description of things, it feels like the fearsome cat that was facing off against the humans, it feels like they were facing off against modern humans, because they're like, one of the things that Perow's explanation of the visuals represents is the idea that they were potentially carrying guns. And guns are a relatively recent weapon in terms of all of human history and such like. Mm-hmm. If they were carrying something more obvious, like simple melee weapons, then Harao might be more likely to recognize that. Obviously, this is extrapolation on my part, because she doesn't understand them, and so therefore we don't necessarily understand them, mm-hmm. but it's still, you know, we're drawing upon recent experience here as well, whereas the kind of weapons we would expect humans to carry would be guns, whether it's old-style muskets or more modern guns like would exist today, or even, you know, far future guns, which still all have a generally similar shape to them and everything. Mm-hmm. But so now we ask ourselves about how that relates to what's going to go forward for the interaction, potential further interactions between cats and humans, as far as a potential confrontation between someone that is going to actually pose a threat to them, as opposed to Miguel, which who can't pose a threat to anybody. Like, he doesn't have a gun to begin with, but that's also just not really the kind of person he is, although we'll get more into explaining the way Miguel is once he starts to be able to tell his story. Mm-hmm. So it adds an overall level of, not fear exactly, but sort of dread, as we take into
account. There's an uncertainty.
Yeah. There's an uncertainty because there is so much we still don't know yet about this world's past, about the Windor that Miguel has come from, what version of Earth that Windor opens up to, and just how interconnected all of these worlds actually are.
Mm.
We're going to draw upon the stuff that we've already talked about, because that's something that everybody should be familiar with, at the very least, as far as if you're fans of Through the Windor and are reading along new with New Century, the way we are trying to make the podcast accessible to you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems clear that these Windors into alternate worlds don't exist naturally. Mm-hmm. Or if they do, we haven't had that experience with. We know now that the doors that brought the Wendigo into James and Abigail's world, they were opened by accident. Like, they were opened by someone that has the power to do so, but they didn't necessarily intend for those doors to open and stay open, in addition. Mm-hmm. So it makes one naturally wonder, okay, where did this Windor come from? And who else might be going around opening up these Windors? And
or what else has Greta and Krieger been up to?
Yeah, because we don't necessarily know that either. I mean, it could all be them, but there also could be other power players out there that are traveling between worlds and interfering in them. Like, we've really only begun the journey of exploring the interconnectedness of them.
Mm.
And it's not hard to believe that even though the current events that we have seen have all implied that at a certain step, things went dramatically backwards because of the effect of portals opening and staying open, and so therefore something coming through that was never intended, that traveling between worlds may have been an extant part of the past of these worlds as well. The very existence of this art implies that something came in from another world, interacted with cats, and that may contribute to why things are the way they are now. But because it's artwork, what that actually means can only be supposition.
Yes, and for the reader, there's a uncertainty and a dread because we've only really seen bad come out of the overlapping of worlds. The Wendigos came into the world of New Century and it caused untold devastation. And I think that the unpreparedness of this world kind of hits home for the audience, especially because more so than it does than for the characters, than they realize, because we're looking at this as alternate history, we can see the world that exists in Let Them Go and Secret Rooms and see that they are not as prepared as the world would be with modern technology, that they are at a even more of a disadvantage than we would be if they came through here.
Not that technology would make that big a difference to us either, at least in terms of the Wendigo. Traditional zombie narratives usually take place in the modern world, after all. If recent events show us anything, we'd be even more fucked if Wendigo came into our world. And I'm not just talking about population density. Even if 2020 hadn't happened, even if the last 4 years hadn't happened, I strongly feel that our media and our government and our medical infrastructure would not be able to handle an outbreak. Never mind that there'd be people going around claiming that Wendigo were fake news and not taking precautions. But I'm going to stop that thread for now, as it just makes me depressed.
I think that it just means that when a creature comes through to a new world, we're unsure if that's a good thing. Even though Miguel is demonstrably harmless, he's nevertheless doesn't belong here, and this really just hammers it home.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. On top of that, there are plenty of parallels that exist in the real world as well as other fictional worlds that we might be familiar with that we are drawing on from this worry of unintended consequences.
Mm.
Among many of Haka's arguments as to why they needed to kill Miguel was that he might contain sickness, And that's a direct reference to how, when Europeans came to the Americas, regardless of if their contact was peaceful or not, they inadvertently brought old-world plagues to aborigines that could not defend against them. From what scholars have been able to determine, these plagues wiped out close to 90% of the aboriginal population long before the colonists came in earnest. For those that are curious to learn more, I'll link an interesting YouTube video from CGP Grey about why those plagues existed in Europe and not in America. But to continue, by the time colonists showed up in force from Europe, part of the reason why they had as easy time of it there as they did was because the damage had already been done and they were facing a much smaller population overall to war with over resources and land when that whole thing happened. And we only have a better understanding of that now that we know how disease and germs and building up immunities, all that sort of thing, actually works.
Thank God we're immune to that in this day and age.
Yeah, exactly. There's another piece of fiction that comes to mind. Did you ever read any Michael Crichton?
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah. He was one of those authors during the 90s that was really big, and it's understandable to get why, because he was the one that gave us, his was the seminal work that brought us Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park.
Yes, now I remember where I've heard the name.
Yeah, and other movies that were based upon his written works were of middling to exceptionally bad, sometimes in an amusing way like Congo, sometimes in not such an amusing way. But there are still components in there that I found particularly brain-expanding at the time that still are one of the defaults that I will have, which is in the novel sphere, when there is scientists that are thinking about, okay, so what are our experiences going to be like making contact with an alien race? What problems are we going to run up against? One of the downfalls that they think of is that other alien races could be so alien that simply the way that they exist could be dangerous to our human biology. Like, instead of a plague going on, it could be that part of their natural biology is taking in oxygen to breathe, but excreting methane or carbon monoxide, something that would be dangerous for us to be around. And carbon monoxide would be particularly bad because we take that in, and carbon monoxide by itself doesn't actually smell like anything, so we wouldn't even know that we were being poisoned by them. Or, alternately, what if their bodies emitted a radiation that we weren't prepared for? We already know how deadly radiation can be to our human bodies. So,
that can't be good.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just unintended consequences on the tragic but unpredictable level, because really, whenever we imagine alien races, for the most part, the dangers that we predict are aliens being hostile, or rather, aliens being like us, in terms of, oh, a nice planet you've got here. Shame if anything were to happen to it.
Do you have a flag?
Yes, exactly so. Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, literally the thing that we are more worried about here is not necessarily something like the Wendigo showing up, although now that we already know that the Wendigo show up, we obviously wonder what would happen if the Wendigo come onto Rama. And so therefore, you know, there are many reasons to be worried about the implications of a portal into Rama. At the moment, the biggest one is humans being humans and coming in and doing war upon the cats, and how that is going to change Rama and is going to affect our protagonists.
Yes, hearing these and seeing these myths also does make Rama become more complex, because we're seeing evidence of a mythology that exists outside of what Haka has told us and his tribe. And much like how mythology in our world can both deviate and share overlapping details and traits, these different depictions of the past and mankind's presence in the world of Rama may agree in some areas and conflict in others, which makes us suspect that they all speak a piece of the truth, but that the whole picture is yet to be revealed.
Well, when you have such great separation like you do of tribes and conflicts between the different races of cats, it may very well be the case that different people have different pieces of the puzzle, and one can only have a greater understanding of everything once you actually put together all of the pieces. It's also true that mythology aside, which is at its core is a story that people tell themselves in order to make sense of who they are with lack of other information. Like in the case of history, where people have written things down and we're keeping track of things so that we know who we are, where we came from, how to learn from the past mistakes, and yet so often not necessarily learning from the past mistakes. The mythologies of our world are generally pure fiction. Having said that, I want to take a moment to clarify. It is entirely possible that some past mythology may have a basis in reality. I haven't done an exhaustive study in the matter, but enough different cultures have a version of the Great Flood myth that it's entirely possible such a flood did happen. On top of that, we already know that written history is not infallible either. History being written by the victors is already a turn of phrase most people know. But even on top of historians pushing an agenda deliberately or through personal bias, we have seen again and again how folklore or fiction will intrude on reality and therefore end up being taught as history. The obvious example is most of the Christopher Columbus story as taught to Americans. But honestly, history is full of such unverifiable stories. Because I love CGP Grey, I'm going to link another video about the seemingly fictional account of how Staten Island became a part of New York instead of New Jersey. But I digress yet again. My point is that, by and large, as modern people, we don't think of miracles and gods and all the like to actually be real, putting Christianity aside for a moment here, but one of the things that we experience specifically in these chapters is that the cats of Rama appear to have access to abilities that we would term as magic. Like, it isn't just the case of the Windors showing up and that being an unusual thing. We now find out that the Silent One is able to gain knowledge that appears to be outside of herself, and we don't necessarily know where that knowledge comes from. And in the very next chapter, we see that Haka has the ability to project his mind into other creatures and is basically able to not simply command them, but use their bodies like they were his own. And he's able to do that not just with one creature, but with multiple creatures. That's pretty impressive and scary. And someone might have claimed they had that kind of power back in the day, but in our world, there has never really been any solid proof that anything extrasensory or magical has ever actually been a part of the world. It's always been a part of fiction, or it's been a part of religious stories.
We have been told stories of monsters with fearsome abilities so far in Tiger's Eye, like the Gagaku.
The Gagaku, yes.
Yeah. And the different gods that are revered in this culture, the Fire Lion?
For completeness' sake, the pantheon as related to us thus far includes a moon goddess, the Tiger of Light, a sun god, Fire Lion, that is also an elemental force and head of the pantheon, and then we have the other elementals, Air Cheetah, Water Leopard, and Earth Jaguar, culminating finally in Dark Panther, who is referred to most times as the Father of Passing, and would seem to be their underworld god.
So the elemental qualities of some of those gods does sort of hint at the possibility of the spiritual and fantastical and just even elemental magic being a potential possibility. But seeing it here, it catches Hrau off guard enough that we know that this isn't something so everyday that it becomes mundane and predictable, but she's quick enough to pick up on cues to understand not only what is going on, but how it's happening. So it's a balance that makes it a surprise to the reader, but also provides enough material for us to infer aspects of the character of this world and what is and isn't possible, and moreover, how common events like this are.
Yeah. Of course, the existence of magic and the existence of the spiritual, of the divine, are still two different things. This is a subject that came up a little bit while editing Maya Santandrea's interview, is that one of the things that she talked about was the idea that, like Tabitha Chorley, Catherine had a very strong Christian faith that she was drawing upon when she was talking to the children at Weirwood and when she was doing her best to ensure that everyone survived the next 10 years of being beset by raiders and Wendigo and making their own resources and everything like that. It's natural for people of the modern world to just completely eschew the idea of gods actually existing and to have opinions that, you know, maybe religion is sometimes more trouble than it's worth, because while it may provide guidelines for living a life that is in tune and in harmony with other people and encourages people to be good, it's just as likely to provide potentially toxic values that other people can take advantage of, or that people can use as free rein to do as they wish, believing they are justified because of their faith in God.
And we're seeing aspects of that here already, with how Hrau is someone who doesn't necessarily seem to be so devout that she is constantly certain of what it is the gods do and wouldn't want. But she respects him enough that she incorporates that into her actions, with how she decides what she will kill, what she won't kill, and things like that. But you are also seeing Hucker, who repeatedly we're told, we suspect he is acting on very personal motivation. He is kind of using the idea that this goes against the gods to further what is very personal to him, which I think is going to show that, for as much as I think Alex wanted to sort of build from the ground up a philosophy / religious set of values that maybe he could get behind to a certain extent, I think he is still showing that all philosophies can be twisted into self-serving. They can use reasoning that ties into and sounds like it endorses and still follows that philosophy, but is directing it in somewhere that serves their needs.
Yeah, it's kind of like the darker aspect of, you know, the term that we use in tropes, be like, well, how did this happen? It doesn't make any sense. A wizard did it. Instead of that, we said, well, why are we doing this? It doesn't seem to make any sense. God wills it. Deus vult. So, yeah, it's not exact. Yeah, you can use the divine, you can use the things that you can't see, and yet people somehow accept anyway as an excuse to justify anything, and that's part of the danger of religion. And by the same token, I don't necessarily know how much Alex is going to do in terms of revealing one way or the other whether certain things actually exist, because we've already seen the dual explanation present, or the fact that he won't commit to whether or not ghosts actually exist, or at the very least, that, you know, maybe some ghosts exist and maybe some ghosts don't actually exist. I'm going to keep this up in the air because maybe the answer isn't actually as interesting as the question, as keeping it a mystery is. So that may very well be the case for great cat gods as well. I doubt that he is necessarily going to get into questions of the Christian God actually existing or his influence on the world either.
This comparison will, I think, require a hear me out, because everyone involved within School of Movies has at one point or another sort of berated this show and the tone of writing. But I will say, in this respect, it reminds me of something you see in Game of Thrones. Now, hear me out. In that, specifically how the gods and abilities granted to certain characters who follow those gods is kind of framed in that show, is that nothing is ever necessarily 100% confirmed. I think as the seasons go on and certain characters are able to pull off, like, increasingly, like, okay, that's pretty impressive, you're probably backing the right horse here, it's never confirmed one way or the other, and you're seeing the abilities, but you don't know if what they're tapping into is something that's more X-Men-y, like certain people have this innate ability and they're ascribing it to a particular god, or if they really are tapping into something that the others aren't able to because they're following false gods or things like that. The level of seeing the results but not knowing exactly what ingredients are involved in their construction, I think allows it to be the right level of mysterious. You know what you need to know for certain, which is, okay, this person is capable of doing X, and you don't know, the right things remain a mystery, because that allows us to go, ooh, I wonder what's going on here. And it gives the characters involved in the story that similar level of uncertainty.
I don't want to go too far down this path, because it feels like there is going to be a lot more room for discussing the divine or agents of the divine or even just agents of the cosmos as we get further into New Century. You probably know what I'm referring to here, so we'll
have some ideas.
Yeah, on that cryptic note, we are still able to draw certain conclusions based on the differences between the Silent One and Haka.
If I pause for a second just to get myself some more water?
You did that on purpose, didn't you? Pause.
No.
All right. Go.
I'll be back.
Little does he know, we've secretly replaced his normal water with new and improved Folger's Crystals water. Will it be rich enough that he won't notice the difference? Let's find out. After having considered it, this actually makes the perfect place to end for this week and pick up next week. So to make it official...
After these messages, we'll be right back.
And to play us out for this episode, we return to the musical stylings of Afro-Celt Sound System. Unfortunately, I don't have any special wisdom to offer on the origins of this song or what makes it special. It is one of my favorite tracks off their third album, even though none of the lyrics are in English. The music is a beautiful mesh of different traditions, and the beat just bounces and gets me moving. Besides, if anyone could be styled after the song's title, it would be our antagonist turned hunter, Haka. I give you Shadow Man.
sound.